Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hannah Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this penultimate session of the BCSC 2021. Adelphi is delighted to be co-hosting the session, Climate-Related Security Risks as an Opportunity for Mediation, with our esteemed partners EIP and the Berghoff Foundation. My name is Janani Vivekananda, and I'm the Head of Program for Climate Diplomacy and Security at Adelphi, and it's my pleasure to facilitate this conversation today. So during this discussion, we will move beyond the question of whether climate security can and should be integrated into mediation and peace building. We, as the three institutions here today, we think the answer is a resounding yes. So we'll instead discuss and explore the important question of how climate and environmental security can help in contexts or conflict-affected contexts to provide opportunities for mediation, for dialogue, and the whole gamut of peace work. But for us, moving beyond this question of if towards the how is a really key step towards moving us from analysis to action, which is really underlying the goal of this year's BCSC. So over the next 45 minutes, we hope to really get into the weeds of this issue, to identify examples of what's working, what's not working, barriers, as well as really practical opportunities to advance our work on this. And to do so, we have two distinguished and highly knowledgeable experts with us. So let me introduce them. First to Janelle Galvanek, who's the head of the Sub-Saharan African Unit at the Berghoff Foundation, where amongst other things, she leads the Berghoff Foundation's projects in Somalia, which support really local level mediation and among local communities. And then we have Michael Keating, who is the Executive Director of the European Institute for Peace, EIP. Michael has been working on promoting and providing practical support on conflict resolution and mediation to states and international institutions for years. Up until 2018, he was the Special Representative to the SG and the head of the UN mission in Somalia. So he'll also be able to share some really practical insights from this context as well. So welcome to Janelle and to Michael, and to you, to the audience. But without further ado, let's get started. Now, I'd like to get straight in and look at what the problem actually is and what's needed. So why is it so important to find ways to include environment and climate change into mediation, dialogue, and peace work? Michael, let's start with you.
I think the short answer is because it's not happening or not happening enough. The problem is that climate change and environmental degradation are clearly contributing to violence and conflict. And the evidence for that is increasingly strong, which doesn't mean we don't need to understand more of the dynamics around that. There are also new forms of violence emerging, more people engaged in conflict. But as you alluded to already, our knowledge of the issues is not yet matched by our understanding of what actions can actually be taken to use an understanding of climate and environment and marry it with the task of preventing and resolving conflict, using it to promote dialogue and to identify ways in which peace agreements can be resolved, let alone future ones prevented. And I think an additional problem is that organizations like ours, Berghoff, tend to work in some of the most fragile states, the poorest states. They do not necessarily have the capability of addressing these dynamics. So naturally, they do seek the solidarity and support of other actors, official and unofficial. And many of them do not really have the tools yet to figure out how to be supportive, because while the solutions do have to come from people and power brokers in these countries, I do think there is scope for working with them. But I would say, just to conclude this part, one part of the problem is that we have a growing body of knowledge about climate and environment and how that affects not just the world, but also people in fragile states, but they tend to be over here. And then you've got another group over here, which is the people who've been doing conflict resolution and dialogue and mediation support over there. And the exciting opportunity, we can call it a problem if you want, but we think it's exciting, is how do you bring these two universes together? Given that, I hope I'm right, Janelle, we are not environmental organizations. We're not climate change organizations. We're conflict resolution bodies. So how do we fit in? How do we contribute to the work of climate actors and environmental actors and use the science and use the knowledge that people have on the ground to move the conflict prevention and resolution agenda forward? And I suppose the problem is we're still in the foothills of this stuff, of understanding how best it can be done.
Thanks, Michael. I like the framing this as an opportunity and an exciting challenge. You mentioned that those in the most affected fragile context don't have the capacity and the tools to address these challenges. Janelle, maybe you can share some insights regarding this issue from your work. I wonder if there is this disconnect between some of the very local level dialogue and mediation that perhaps does address this, maybe we're not aware of it, that is happening, and then that disconnect with maybe the professional peacemaking and peace building activity that you mentioned, this kind of this dichotomy, Michael. So maybe Janelle, do you have some insights that you can share with us from your work from the ground in Somalia, maybe in Galmudug in particular?
Sure. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me and giving me this opportunity. I think maybe just briefly about Somalia in general. I think we are all well aware that Somalia really fits the description of a weak and vulnerable society to climate change and environmental degradation. It fits this description very well. I think the Somalis, particularly in Galmudug State, have been living with climate change for many years. They see this, they're feeling it, they're living in it, but their formal and informal institutions are weak. They don't have the capacity to deal with this. And it's a great challenge for them. And I think in Galmudug specifically, a great majority of the population is reliant either directly or indirectly on pastoralism. And pastoralism has clearly been affected by climate change and environmental degradation. So you have a society that has historically had a lot of conflict between communities over resources. So when you add climate change into that mix, when you add environmental degradation with everything that goes along with it, drought, migration, large numbers of IDPs coming into from rural areas into urban areas, you take an already challenging environment and you make it much more difficult and fragile. And I think what's really needed first, before we even start the conversation or before we even go into the differences of skills, what we found is needed is awareness raising about this topic. So starting this conversation first and foremost, not just at the political level, but at all levels, specifically on the community level. So it's really important to have this conversation about climate security, about the impact of climate change on communities, not just with policymakers, but really with the communities that are affected by this. And we've realized through our work that the communities, although they're living this, they don't necessarily have the information or the knowledge available that's out there in order to have them be able to adapt to this or to really even react to it in a proper way. So specifically, we organize large-scale dialogue assemblies. We build the capacity of local peace builders, local mediators, insider mediators, if you will. And one thing that we also have done is created a radio program that is aired every couple of weeks. And it really allows us to reach a larger audience, a critical mass, if you will, on issues of climate change and the impact of climate change on conflict, on livelihoods, on society in general. And of course, there are a lot of other things that are needed. But I think really, initially, the very first thing that you need to do is raise awareness about this topic so that we can all be on the same page about it.
Thanks, Janelle. I wonder, beyond the awareness raising, once we get there, where do we go from here? Michael, you mentioned that climate and environment is not just something we need to take account of to make sure peace is sustainable, but it can also be an opportunity for promoting peace. Can you tell us a bit more about how climate change can be a peace enabler? How can we use climate-related security risks as an opportunity for conflict resolution? And do you have any examples?
First of all, let me just say that I agree with Janelle about the awareness raising and get people to recognize that this is not some kind of marginal issue, but is actually pretty fundamental. And to begin to answer your question, Janelle, one of the things that you can do is look at what are often thought of as hardcore political issues that have nothing to do, superficially at least, with climate change and environment, and try and understand them from the perspective of climate change dynamics and environmental dynamics. So, for example, control of security forces. That is usually approached in terms of which tribal group, or is it the central government or the local government or this, that, and the other. And that's the typical conversation that goes on. But when you look at what security forces are actually doing, which is often protecting or trying to seek access to resources, you can bring a whole new perspective to bear on how they behave, what motivates them, what incentivizes them. One of the things that you can do is start applying a climate and environmental lens two issues which don't superficially, at least, seem to have anything to do with climate and environment. And that's similarly true with revenue raising, control of resources, and distribution of resources. It can be to do with things like humanitarian assistance. There's so many ways in which this knowledge can be applied. But I think in terms of very practical things, what Janelle is talking about, using an understanding of these issues to promote new forms of dialogue, essential, reframing existing political problems from an environment and climate perspective is extraordinarily important. Identifying and using common concerns across conflict lines and helping parties to conflict to recognize that actually they often have more in common or as much in common as divide them, and then figuring out how you can invest in those areas in ways that try and build trust, reduce tensions, and possibly attract investment. And one of the things I would say here is that, you know, peace agreements fail and work for many different reasons. But one of them is if they don't have an investment package behind them that is addressing both the concerns of parties to conflict, but are also delivering meaningful dividends for ordinary people to address the insecurity that is contributing to conflict, they are less likely to work. So an understanding of what investments are needed in the climate and environment space and linking that to trying to make sure that local agreements or national agreements or international agreements are likely to work, that's a very exciting area. And I don't think we're doing enough of that. We're not looking at how do you use a knowledge of what investments are required for adaptation and to a certain degree mitigation. How can that be used, for example, for disarmed combatants? How can it be used to support marginalized groups? How can it be used to invest in biodiversity or land replenishment or forest management in ways that will contribute to the likelihood of success of a peace agreement? I am not saying that they are the answer to everything, but they have a much more meaningful contribution to make than they have done so far.
Thank you so much. There was so much there, but I think the point around investments being so core, and it's not just about the natural resources, but also a lot of the climate aid that is coming into these fragile contexts that are also climate vulnerable, that could either be a resource that can be looted or it could be used as a kind of incentivizing commodity for peace. And I don't think I haven't really come across anything that's covering this. Janelle, do you have any examples or do you have any thoughts on some of the point that Michael made?
Well, I think when you get into the topic of environmental peace building, I think on the one hand, there are a lot of opportunities there. And on the other hand, you have to be really careful with how you approach it. I think in Somalia, you have a lot of resource conflicts that have potentially been going on for many years. So let's say you have a land conflict or a land theft that happened 30 years ago in the framework of the beginning of the Somali Civil War, and you have a marginalized community that has been disenfranchised by this land theft, and they've been suffering dramatically since then because of this. A lot of this, the root causes of this conflict go back to the major structural inequalities that are present in Somalia and the fact that nobody's really talking openly about this simply because there are a lot of people benefiting from these structural inequalities. But you have the root cause of a conflict that is based there. And in order to really resolve this conflict definitively, it takes a holistic approach. You need to have some sort of land reform angle to it and ideally some attempt at dealing with the past. However, given that these conflicts have been going on for so long and there hasn't been any real breakthrough in terms of resolving them, I think bringing in an environmental aspect to it is an opportunity. It's not saying that this is going to solve the problem and bring two groups together to talk and build trust is going to make peace and bring about reconciliation between these two groups. But at the same time, it's an entry point. It can be used as an entry point. It can be used to build trust and begin a constructive dialogue on a topic that is less divisive, that they can find common ground on, they have some sort of common objective. So I think there are much more creative ways that we can use this in the field of conflict resolution that have not yet been explored. Not at all, actually. And I think that as long as we're very realistic about it and make sure that we make a conscious effort to do no harm, I think that these entry points should definitely be pursued.
Thank you. I know we're focusing on conflict resolution and mediation, but Michael, you've touched on some really interesting points around security sector reform and disarmament and demobilization and reintegration processes, which are very critical next step from there. Have you any insights on how either practically this might be happening, the kind of inclusion of climate and environment into things like the retraining of security personnel or reintegrating ex-combatants into new livelihoods? Have either of you come across examples of this actually happening, either intentionally or just ad hoc that might be something that could be replicated?
Do you know, it's such a good question, and my answer has to be no. I am not aware of a systematic catalogue of this, but as you say, there are many ad hoc examples of it. I am not an expert on the Northern Irish peace process, but I understand that one of the things that happened in Northern Ireland is that some of the groups that were demobilised then were supported to take on new responsibilities, which also included regeneration of communities. This is more urban than rural, and maybe it's a bit of a stretch to call it environment, but there was a real sense that you can't just expect people to demobilize. They have to have a sense of respect and responsibility. Similarly, another little anecdotal kind of story, which doesn't really answer your question, but when I was in Afghanistan living there, that is now about a decade ago, I did go and visit a number of communities where there were projects being supported that were deliberately targeted at young men on the grounds that young men often tend to be the ones who can end up being sucked into groups or getting engaged in illicit economic activity. And in a funny kind of way, that was an example of this. I think if you're suggesting that we do some kind of more systematic catalog of this, that is a very, very good idea. Just it occurs to me, and I've mentioned this before in a previous meeting, that I was talking to many of the negotiators for the Afghan talks, which now, of course, have completely collapsed and gone away, and attempts to get some of these issues raised in those talks got absolutely nowhere. And that's really sad. And even today, given the crisis facing Afghanistan, you know, is there scope for looking at how investment in climate-related and environmental issues could actually, even in the craziness of what's going on, be used to help the population cope in ways that don't compromise our values at a time when otherwise there's no money available? The appetite to provide money is pretty close to zero. But there is a sense that just letting things drift, and if there's one area in which some kind of investment is probably politically acceptable, partly for selfish reasons by the West, it is in the area of climate change and environment. So I do think there are real opportunities here.
Thank you. And the great examples. And it's incredibly frustrating, this conversation on Afghanistan, and the number of times I've also heard, you know, that comes later. Climate change is really not the priority. That comes later. And you just think, this is an entry point. And if you're not thinking about environment and climate as part of what underpins any kind of stabilizational piece, then we're missing this. But I think that speaks to your point, Janelle, about awareness raising, right, at all levels, not just community, but...
Can I ask you a question, Janani? In the same way that you're coming up an idea of doing this kind of review of these... Oh. I mean, one question I have is... To what degree do you think nationally determined contributions from fragile and conflict-affected states should also be looking at these opportunities, or is that off the scale?
I'm just a humble moderator, Michael, but, but I personally think absolutely NDC should be passed through a conflict filter. And I think there's a huge amount of value of having conflict and peace building experts be part of these conversations, because there's then a different view to see how to go beyond just the technical climate adaptation and mitigation goals to actually look at how to build sustainable peace into these and how to get that double dividend, which it's not in anyone's job description on the climate front. It's not part of the UNFCCC's mandate. So it's just not going to be there unless the peace building community is really actively engaged, and there need to be incentives for this as well. And I think that's partly what we're trying to do with these conversations and do a bit of cross-fertilization. But yeah, maybe on this point, Janelle, from what you've seen working, what do we need to do to ensure that sustainable peace does go in hand with a sustainable environment? I think what we've seen is that people respond to evidence, and you're working on the ground. So what kind of evidence can you speak to?
Thanks. I think one of the things that peace builders talk about is systemic conflict and systemic conflict transformation. And I think for us, understanding conflict holistically and understanding how to resolve conflict holistically is actually, it's quite easy for us to see how climate change affects all of this. It's just one other element in the whole system of conflict, in the whole system of trying to resolve conflict. We've been working in Somalia for many years, and we support communities in their efforts to achieve a sustainable peace. And we do this by supporting community level actors, insider mediators, if you will, to build their capacity. And they already have platforms in society. They are religious leaders, transitional leaders, women's group leaders, youth activists, professionals, teachers, you name it, business representatives of the business community. And they're very active for peace. They're you're out there mediating conflicts, resolving conflicts, just playing a positive role in society for peace. And so we have this basis to work from. And one of the things that I've found so interesting over the past year is how easy it has been to connect the work that we've been doing to climate security and to working on the environment. It's something that I didn't necessarily think before, but after working with this programming for 9 months, it's become quite clear to me how intimately interlinked these two things are. And it's not a stretch to say that adding the issues of climate security and showing or demonstrating how climate change has impacted people's lives in Somalia, specifically in Galmudug State, has really broadened people's understanding of conflict and what the conflict is about and how to mediate and handle that conflict. And I think it's been really well received in Galmudug. One of the things that we've been doing is carrying out together with Adelphia climate risk assessment, where we really carry out individual interviews with dozens of people on a monthly basis to listen to them, to listen to what's happening in their lives, how they're being impacted by climate change and what they think is potentially a possibility to become more resilient to climate change. And we ask a lot of different questions, but one of the things that we realize is how receptive people are to this. They are very receptive to this. They want to learn more. They're very eager to open this conversation. And one of the things that we found that is extremely interesting is that it's not just about climate change. So people aren't just talking about the climate change due to industrialized countries and Somalis being the victim of that, but it's actually opened up a very interesting conversation about environmental degradation and the role that Somalis themselves have played in this and the role that, for instance, the charcoal trade has played in this and what that has led to in terms of environmental degradation and desertification and so on. And this has really gotten people thinking, at least in our dialogue assemblies, about what role they have to play. So it's not just about conflict and it's not just about the environment. It's really bringing these two things together. And I think it enables the insider mediators that we work with not only to have a different understanding of conflict, so critically seeing that climate change angle to it, that environmental angle, but it has also made them more champions of the environment in that sense. So they're really proponents of trying to stop or even reverse environmental degradation in their communities. And this is really fundamental for us. So it's really combining these two things. It's not at all a stretch. It's working quite well.
Thank you. This is now curiosity. Michael mentioned the very practical role that the environment and climate link can play in some of the traditional peacebuilding trajectories. And you mentioned the kind of challenges in the case of Afghanistan of unemployed young men. One thing that we know very well is unemployed young men usually are dealt with livelihood schemes, but we know that it needs to go beyond just the provision of a job, and people are looking for dignity and addressing the intergenerational kind of break that's happened. Do you see, just from what I heard you say, it sounds the opportunities around things like environmental regeneration and addressing kind of land and people's homelands, do you see this as an opportunity to maybe build into some of these livelihood creation schemes so that you are going beyond just providing young men with jobs, but providing them with a scope for dignity and a position in their community? And it's a bit of a loaded question, but do you have any kind of actual insights based on just speculation on my part?
I do. We're at the very beginning of this. I see huge opportunity, actually. And I think it's because, specifically just talking about Galmudug State, like I said before, so much of the population is dependent either directly or indirectly on pastoralism. And this plays a huge role in society in Galmudug and the psyche of the Galmudug people. They are pastoralists and they have this connection to the land. And when you have many people losing their livelihoods, losing their livestock to climate change, to drought, to conflict often that is a result of this climate change, they've lost their connection to the environment. So I think that Somalis, they love their country, they love their nature, they love this connection. And they've, from our understanding, have really felt quite remorseful about what is happening to their environment. And I think that if they're given the right skills and the capacity to be able to do these types of things, the regeneration in that way, that there would be a lot of opportunity. However, that capacity, that opportunity is not there yet. I think maybe one really concrete example that we've discussed is we had a dialogue assembly in a town in Galmudug called Adado. And one of the main issues that came up during that entire 6-day assembly was a discussion about tree planting and about the forests that used to be around the region of Adado and how they're gone. And now it's a really dry, barren landscape. And people are very sad about that. And they're asking the question, what can we do? And that leads back to the conversation about potentially investments. And when you have a charcoal trade that the people are benefiting from, but is also destroying the environment, how do you stop that vicious cycle from happening? You can't expect people to stop cutting their trees if they don't have alternative means of fuel. You cannot expect that. So how do you bring in incentives for the people, and how do you create a long-term thinking on this so that you can save the environment at the same time, but create opportunities, employment opportunities for the people who potentially have lost their opportunities, their livelihood from climate change? It's all connected in that way. And I see lots of opportunities, but it's not happening yet.
Thank you. Michael, maybe I can come to you with maybe the flip side of this. It's a question from one of the audience members, Christian Altpeter, who asks, how do we also ensure guard against the elite capture of maybe some of these opportunities that we've discussed around climate security being a new dimension, bringing in new resources that can be harnessed by bad actors in a conflict or fragile setting?
Well, not easily. And that's a big question. Sometimes people think that, for example, a switch to new forms of energy is going to allow a much more accountable and sustainable and equitable approach to economic development. But unfortunately, the evidence is that is not necessarily the case. You can replicate the bad practices that take place around fossil fuels in terms of accessing new resources that are needed for energy. And similarly, access to land and water tends to be dominated by those who are in a position to exercise power and are supported. I do like what Janelle said about the agency of people, even in the poorest and most resource-deprived situations. So people do have very strong views about this, and they do want accountability, in my view, more than they want democracy. They want to know that those who are in positions of authority, whether that are groups or politicians or people otherwise, are prepared to be accountable. So the issue is, how can that sense of accountability be strengthened? And I do worry, and I hope this is partly answering the question, that sometimes the way the international community behaves results in power brokers and policymakers feeling somewhat more accountable to the international community than they do to the people in the areas that they control. So it is extraordinarily important to do what is a well-known technique in the conflict resolution world, although it's not done enough and it's not seriously enough, is trying to understand the perspectives of people who are experiencing this insecurity, understanding what their aspirations are, and trying to make sure that that is connected in muscular ways into conversations about governance, about political processes, about political agreements. And actually, we're not very good at it. I mean, again, you could use Yemen as another example. There's lots of talks going on. How many of them are responding to what ordinary people actually consider to be the real drivers of their insecurity? And they're not. It's all about who gets the weapons and who's got the money and who gets the bank accounts and who gets the access to the oil resources and so on. So to the degree that we can contribute to strengthening the agency of people in these places and the sense of accountability and responsibility to them, and if an approach through environment and climate can turbocharge that or strengthen it, donors, among others, realize that this is really important, I think that may go some way to mitigating the problem. But again, in all this, one thing I do want to be clear on is that the dynamics and drivers of conflict are multifold. Environment and climate are not the only ways into this, but they have got a much bigger role to play than they have played in the past. I don't want to say it's the answer, but it's under invested in, underutilized, underexploited as a means to advance conflict resolution, prevention, and dialogue.
Thank you. No, I think that's a really important point to stress. And it is a huge opportunity. And this seems to be the year with COP26. But I do feel like this conversation about embedding power dynamics and understanding of power dynamics and political economy. And there's an idea, I think, that climate action is just an unalloyed good that is apolitical, that is just technical, not across the board, but it is a very strong trend. And so there isn't really an understanding of how to do this in fragile context without inadvertently fueling some of these dynamics that you mentioned, Michael, that we don't want to replicate. So yes, hoping that we can cross-fertilize better around this. And this does seem to be an important moment. And hopefully we can look at how this can also be structurally addressed in the climate change aid architecture as well, because again, conflict is almost invisible in any of the big climate funds. So I guess rapidly running out of time, I can't believe how quickly it's gone, but maybe on this point as a final question, what do you think would be the most important step to ensure that at a structural or institutional level, either on the climate change side or on the peace building and peacemaking stabilization side, what would be the most important step, if you were to name one, to try and ensure that this nexus around environmental peacemaking and integrating climate into peacemaking and peacebuilding is better institutionalized? Janelle, maybe start with you.
Thank you. I think for me, there's one very clear answer, and it goes back to what Michael said at the beginning about people in our field, peace builders, we're not climate experts, and we don't have to be. For me, the answer is really better and more institutionalized partnerships on this, really joining forces with other fields. This needs to be a multidisciplinary effort. There's no way we can be climate experts. That's not what we do. What we do, what we excel at, our strength is bringing people together to creating space to have these conversations and building the capacity of actors, whether government actors or local actors, community level actors, insider peace builders, to engage in mediation on these topics. So I think that's really key. I think there's a lot of hesitancy on the part of many individuals and organizations to get involved in this topic simply because, let's be honest, it's complex. People don't know really where to start. And I think that understanding that you don't have to go it alone is really important. And I think we need to be much more creative going forward about specifically answering the question, what now? I think awareness has been raised. We're having these conversations. We are building the capacity of people on these topics. But I think that for me, the elephant in the room, or the elephant in the next room, I guess you could say, is what happens now? How do you really build the resistance of resilience of communities to climate change? How do you really help resolve conflicts with an environmental peacebuilding angle? And what comes in? And that leads back to incentives. And I think the only way to do this is to partner with other organizations on this, especially for EIP and for Berkoff and for other organizations like us, to partner with development organizations so that they can come in and offer real tangible results from this to communities in Somalia and worldwide in order for them to be able to continue this conversation. So for me, it's really about partnerships.
Thank you so much, Janelle. And Michael, what do you think?
I think Janelle has said it all, but I'm tempted to be mischievous and just use one word. Money. You know, I've had this conversation with so many people. This is going to take off this. But I can tell you, trying to get financial support to do this work, it's like pulling teeth. It's incredibly hard work. I do think there needs to be more deliberate investment in this nexus between conflict prevention, conflict resolution, dialogue and mediation, environment and climate change. And if there are impediments to that, whatever they are, we need to understand what they are. But I do think a little bit more investment in this space. Now, I recognize it is a bit of a risk, this, because I think we're all saying we're at the beginning of this. We haven't got all the answers, but we're never going to get there unless we invest more in this. The other thing I would say, in addition to applauding what Janelle said about partnerships, because I think that's incredibly important, is figuring out which actors have what to contribute and how they can work with each other. But the other thing is to say that, you know, in doing this work, it should ideally not only yield practical things that can be done on the ground in these places, but I think the policy dimension is incredibly important as well. And organizations like CIPRI and Adelphi, I think, are doing fantastic work in this space. It's really great. But I still think their work can be enriched even further by having some practical experience and then taking those policy implications back to capitals. It's not just about what you do with your dollar in Somalia. It's about what are the things that need to happen in donor capitals in terms of trying to bring more holistic approaches together to address some of these problems.
Thank you. I wholeheartedly agree with all of that. And yes, I think we don't need to wait for the full empirical kind of evidence base to be able to then inform that policy discussion. There is stuff we know already that we can already start feeding in. So I think we were just talking amongst the panel before the session started about how far we've come over the past few years. Last year at BCSC 2020, there was a conversation also with the Berkoff Foundation, with Andrew Gilmore, and also with Gunter Bechler, the diplomat, discussing a similar theme, looking at why and how climate change and environmental considerations should be a core part of conflict analysis and peace building. And now we've really had this incredibly substantive conversation of what this should look like. I wonder if, just in a minute, I'd love to hear from you, Janelle, what progress you think we've made in the last year in your eyes. And then maybe Michael, I'd like to hear from you what more progress we need to see in the years to come.
Thanks. I think we've made quite a bit of progress in the last year. I think that at least for us specifically, the conversation has gone beyond just the theory of it, but really implementing work on climate security on the ground in Somalia, in a place where I think the Bearclaw Foundation has the networks and the local actors and the support to do this. I think this takes specifically a long time to build up. And I think that over the years of us working in Somalia, we're now at a good place where we can actually make use of the networks that we have and the approach that we use to really make positive for climate security or addressing the impacts of climate change. And I think that's a huge success. I think really stepping from theory into practice is the main step. And I think that, sure, there's where we will make mistakes along the way and that there will be lots of lessons learned. But I think given the urgency of the situation and given the fact that climate change is going to exacerbate conflict ever more in Somalia, not just in Galmudug State, but elsewhere. And I think that we really need to make sure that we see the urgency in that. And there's really no reason to wait anymore. You don't have to have a perfect program to get it started. Just really, we need to implement more.
Thank you, Janelle. And Michael, what progress do we need to see in the coming years?
That's a different question. But you said progress has taken place. All right. Well,
you can answer the formal one if you'd rather.
No. It's your prerogative, whatever. But anyway, I was going to answer by saying that I think Janelle is right. It's about we're deepening our knowledge of practical things. I would say that over the couple of years that I've been with our institute, I would like to think that with partners, we have moved the dial a bit in terms of raising an awareness among conflict resolution, dialogue, and mediation actors that this stuff needs to be taken very seriously and that it has potential. I would say that 2 years ago, there were only a couple of us talking about this stuff, and now no self-respecting conflict resolution organization avoid talking about this stuff. So that's a shift. I think there have been a number of conversations with the European Union. We've contributed to that, and they now have environmental peacemaking as part of their conflict resolution concept. That's important because these things will play out over time. I would like to think that we've contributed also some to the thinking of the UN. The UN has the climate security mechanism and lots of things going on that have nothing to do with us. But I think we've also tried, and I'd say we, to encourage mediators to think about how an understanding of these issues can enrich their work. It is very difficult. It's not easy to figure out how to do it because we still have this problem that people tend to be either climate or environment experts, or they tend to be conflict resolution and dialogue people. And we still haven't quite worked out what that sweet spot is and how to support it and how to turn it into something practical. So I think there has been big progress, but there is a very long way to go.
Thank you. Yeah, I think as a community of practice, we have moved the dial and we can just keep on moving it. I wish we could carry on this conversation. It's been so interesting and I have learned so much, but sadly we're out of time and I apologize also over time. So we'll wrap it up here to our panelists today. Michael, Janelle, thank you so much for your insightful and invaluable insights. I think we've come a long way. And thanks to this discussion, I think really have got a number of really nuanced, practical insights around how exactly climate-related security risks can act as an opportunity for mediation. We also have some next steps, I think, and even a new research agenda. But where do we go from here? I think a number of you in the call today as well, we're all kind of looking at this issue, working towards moving that dial further. And the three of us in this panel, Adelphi, EIP, and Bearclaw, along with other participants or partners, will also be taking this specific issue further next year in a very practical way, looking at piloting some of these approaches, evaluating the outcomes on peace, identifying best practices and what can be mainstreamed and replicated around including environment and climate change into mediation and peacemaking processes. So if you're interested in that, please do stay in touch. And with that, I draw this session to a close. So thank you again to Janelle and Michael and for sharing your wisdom, and to you, the audience, for tuning in and participating in this session. And apologies for overrunning. Thank you so much for joining, and goodbye.